way you can put it in a chair or what you, whatever you want to do with it. And fill, put them strings in there. Get your, that's you got your pillow. So now, your, none of your clothes, that you ain't got to throw them away. Well, a lot of times I'll pass by places and look on the garbage. There is brand new clothes people throw it away. They can take them. If they don't want them, they can make something out of them to use. And now you, that quilt, that's a quilt. And this, you see, all this here you see is old clothes. Now this here is sweatsuits. That's what you make your sweatsuits out of.
That's sweatshirt material.
Yeah, that's what it is. Sweatsuit material. But you can take dungaree, you can take corduroy, well, you can take any kind of material. But I don't use wool and I don't use silk. I use any other kind. I chamois, huntsman, yanghams, corduroy, blue denim. I use it all, but I don't use the silk, and neither they are wool. Well, the silk, it rolls too much. You can't keep it straight. That's why I come out on don't bother with it. Now, is there any questions?
Why don't you use the wool?
Well, the wool, I just don't like it.
Too hot for Florida?
I don't like it. you get hold to a wool piece, if you don't move it, that wool, you just fold it up and put it somewhere. When you get ready to open it up, you got to see holes all through it. Well, if something get hold to it, they eat it up. But they don't eat cotton and, you know, chamois and corduroy and all that. They don't eat that much. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he was living in 35, I know. I say he was living in 35 because he is my mother's mother, grandfather. I mean father, what I mean. Excuse me. And he was the man that learned me how to try to do everything I could to help myself. Don't ask nobody. You can ask your brother. He may not want to do it. You can ask your sister. She may not want to do it. You can ask your mother. She may not want to do it. But if you go ahead and study your way out, you can do it yourself. So I built my rooms onto my house. I built little buildings out to put up my feet in. I didn't ask my mother, my father, my brother, my husband, or none of them. I built it myself. I plowed the field just like my daddy used to do. And I tell you, my daddy used to have some old mules that he'd scare you to go in the lot with them. But you know what he said? He said, anything I feed, I'm going to handle it. And I was the oldest child at least. And this is the way he said it. Y'all excuse me for saying it like that. But I'm going to tell you like he told me. He said, "Hot damn it, you go in that lot and catch that mule." And the mule doing like this. He said, "Put that whip on him." Slap him with the whip. He say, "Eek!" Like he coming to me. Every time he do, he say, "He's hot damn it, put it on him." That's the way that whip I put it on to that mule, hold his head and I can put the bridle on him. Go on anywhere I wanted with him. And I had one myself after I married. I had one myself. Nobody in the family could catch that mule. Might go in there a lot and catch him.
Do we have any more questions for Ms. Jones? Well, thanks a lot for coming out here.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Ms. Jones will be in the crafting area back here. Be sure and go in there. There are some other crafters and some display, some other things that are on display. So be sure and go inside and take a look. Can't hear us. Just talking to the mic. This is on now.
This is on.
Okay. He's on.
It's on?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Jesse Trevelyan. I'm from the Big Thicket. Now,
where's the Big Thicket? Yes.
The Big Thicket is deep east Texas. If you're looking at a map of Texas and Louisiana, and you would need both, the Big Thicket begins at approximately Beaumont, which is north of Houston, and goes for several hundred miles north along the Sabine River. It is a unique geological find in the sense that the United Nations has marked the Big Thicket as a man and his biosphere. There are a lot of scientists studying in the Big Thicket. It is formed by a major upheaval in the earth, where the earth raised up and then slams back down. When it does that, what is formed are mountains way to the west, mountains to the east, and the Big Thicket in the middle. Behind the Big Thicket would then be desert. In front of it would be the state of Louisiana. This accounts for the fact that in the waters of the Big Thicket, you can find fish that belongs in the deep sea. It does not belong in fresh water at all. But in the descending years, these fish are now freshwater fish by nature, but in appearance, they still look like they belong in the ocean. The Big Thicket gets its name from the fact that it is very, very thick. You would not be able to walk in the Big Thicket from here to that restroom area there in the unmarred portion of it without taking some kind of equipment to move things out of the way. It's very, very thick. A normal American deer that would be about this size in the Big Thicket is about that high because animal life there has had to adjust itself to the nature of the land, the nature of the thicket. Its geological specificity is that almost anything, any kind of a plant life, any kind of tree, will grow in the Big Thicket. It's hot, it's damp, and from my childhood years, it has more snakes than there is any place else in the world. Just about every variety you can mention, they're in the thicket. It's unique in that sense that it is not a natural formation that was before, say, the dinosaurs or anything of that sort. It was unexplored until almost my lifetime. Native Americans never camped in the Big Thicket. They hunted on the edge of the Big Thicket, but they never entered the Big Thicket for fear of getting lost and never finding the way out. Now, when American lumber industry started to move west, two Caucasians from the state of Mississippi called the Weir Boys went with their industry into what is now East Texas and establish what is now called Weirgate. Weirgate, Texas, is named after those two brothers. What they took with them were workers from Mississippi, Alabama, that particular area. One of the young men they took with them was a man named Henry Trevelyan. I'm that man's son. This man was taken from Brookhaven, Mississippi, almost slave-like in the sense that a sum of money is given to his mother, and he then goes away with this company to be their section foreman. A section foreman is what we would now call a track laying engineer. His job is to command men on pitch, by talking on pitch. If you by chance saw the movie Color Purple, you saw a railroad scene in there. Well, they checked out of the Library of Congress one of Henry Trevelyan's records, and it's used in that movie for that particular scene. And what you got is a man who's standing in hearing distance of, say, approximately 70 men. And they are either tamping tires, unloading tires, whatever, and all the orders are given on cue, and all of which would now be lost, except that in the late 20s, the Library of Congress decided to preserve American folklore in the raw. One of the first person funded to go out and research this and record it was a man named John Lomack. Now, John Lomack, born in Mississippi like my father was, family moved to Texas at an early age. When he, as a graduate of Harvard University, goes into folklore, it's a pioneering of what you do. You don't study folklore now without studying John Lomack. Well, he is given the equipment, given the contract to go and find one Henry Trevelyan, record him in the raw, record him as he does what his craft is, talk on pitch. Give instructions on pitch. My dad even talked, gave his anger out on pitch and in rhythm. So there exist 52 recordings in the Library of Congress of Henry Trevelyan as recorded by John Lomack. I witnessed most of these recordings that are not in the woods on the railroad track, where no kid, of course, would have been allowed. What we didn't know as members of the family was that this was under contract of the Library of Congress. We thought this was an old white man with a big machine, and he liked to come around colored people and record what they said, and especially if they sung or told a story, he'd record it. There's this great big apparatus sitting there with a dog listening to his master's voice. That was a recording machine. 15-inch disc were made. I made several buffalo nickels out of John Lomack to sweep up the hair that the recording machine made. In the process of that thing making a recording, it cut the disc and made one big mess of hair. Well, I got one nickel to clean it up. I don't know that I ever really did it, but I was the recipient of the nickel. We had clean hardwood floors, and this stuff would be fairly easily removed. You're talking about a time before a whole lot of radio. You're talking about a time with no television. So storytelling was not only a recording of history for us, it was entertainment, and which is what we thought it was. But on the weekend of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I chanced to be in a home in Upper Ridgewood, New Jersey, where at that particular time in that part of New Jersey, no African-American owned anything. A Quaker family is being uppity by having an African-American stay with them in what was a segregated community. We watched President Kennedy's funeral just about all day, and late in the evening decided to turn off the tube and go into their music room, a very nice room in their home there in Upper Ridgewood, where there was a grand piano. Rather than have my host play music on the piano, he decided he wants to play for me some of his folk music. I had gone from folk to classical. He had gone from classical to folk. Me being African American, him being European American, so the debate was which one we would hear, classical or folk. He being the guy's host, I gave in. All right, let's hear some folk. He plays a recording by one Josh White. And I said, wait a minute. I started to sing ahead of Josh White in recording. I knew all these, the lyrics. He said, "You've heard this before?" "Yeah, but not that guy. I heard my father sing this." So he gets up, goes to the other side of the room, on the other side of the grand piano, picks up the jacket of the record. Now, this is something the kids will not experience anymore because we don't have these kind of records anymore. But on the record jacket, it reads, "For the original of this song, see Library of Congress number, et cetera, et cetera, by Henry Trevelyan." So Jack says to me, "Do you know somebody named Henry Trevelyan?" I said, "Yeah, that's my father." The next morning, we are on the horn to the Library of Congress, and want to know, we got a record here by my father. He says, "Yeah, that whole family is dead. We've been trying to find them for years, but of this Henry Trevelyan, there are 52 recordings here. And they are on very delicate material, will only sustain one more playing. Then they will have to be destroyed. And the law is somebody in that family has to finance the transfer of the material that's on the record to tape." Now, we had gone very progressive in this country at that point. We had reel-to-reel tape, 1/2 inch width, and that was considered very modern recordings. That's now way obsolete. But they needed $30 to preserve 52 records. So I catch a train from New Jersey and go down to Washington, D.C. and listen to 52 recordings of my father, with my older sister singing on some of the recordings and my mother singing on several of them. John Lomax was good to get what he called colored people to sing for him. He especially wanted to record them singing, clapping their hands, doing all sorts of things. When he would get around college communities, they would refuse to do anything for him. And he so writes that in his book, The Ballad Hunter. Gets upstaged by these uppity blacks, as he called them, uppity coloreds, as he actually says, who gets an education and then don't want to sing their beautiful music. Now, the modern scholars have all their criticism of John Lomax. What I know for a fact is John Lomax and my father were very personal friends. John Lomax spent a lot of time in our home at a time when that was against the law. And consequently, we have all this history, all of this material of one Henry Trevelyan and the 70 so men who worked under him as recorded by John Lomax on the contract. Now, John Lomax's son, Alan Lomax, came with him on several of these trips to my family out in the Big Thicket. Alan has recently retired as a professor of folklore at Columbia University in New York. Remembers me being a very little boy around these recording machines as he helped his dad with. And so that story goes. But the life in the Big Thicket was a peculiar kind of life in the sense that a child was just simply not allowed to wander off into the forest. You may never see that kid again. Unless the kid, like I had a horse, rode a horse into the thicket. I was actually born in the first house finished for an African American in Weargate, Texas. Weargate, Texas is still there. When I grew up, when I was born there, this was a booming, logging town. Like the woman who spoke here before me, red clay. It was muddy all the time, muddy and stinky. There was one big store called Commissary where everybody met, and it was literally a storytelling place. So you want to hear what's going on, latest gossip, latest truth, who died or who cheated on the wife or anything of that sort, go to the commissary and sit around the store, around the porch, and you would hear all of it. You didn't need a newspaper, just listen to folk talk. It was all there. All right, any other questions?
I can
go on and on with this, but
yeah, I certainly have a lot of questions. I'm not sure which way to go with this.
The recordings are available. Several staff people of the Library of Congress have made a lot of money off those recordings. They have published books and articles making comment on those recordings, you can buy little audio cassettes of them, kind of recordings that they're making here, of several of those. Some are more entertaining than others. The music on those, the music on the right of way, probably the most famous of them is one called Unloading Rails, where you hear men actually throw a rail into place. And you hear my dad give the command, all right, throw it away. And you hear, bang! And if they did it correct, that's all you're going to hear. If they did it wrong, you didn't hear another sound, meaning that rail moved. These men were worked into a frenzy to the degree that you were not allowed to really catch a wind anywhere. If you throw that one down, run back and get another one. And you'd hear him say that. Somebody stand around or try to catch their breath. You hear him yell at that person, are you laying off now? Are you going to be out tomorrow? Anybody give you any talk back? Okay, I'll give you about a 90-day layoff. Well, you understand how threatening this was, since these men made about $2 a day while my dad was making $3.50 a day. Well, they thought he was an extremely privileged person. He's making $3.50 a whole day. Whereas a good worker, seasoned worker, was making $2 a day. Now, when the railroad played out in Weargate, all these men are let go. No severance pay, nothing. Work stopped one day, and Weargate, like, died.
I wonder if you could... Can you demonstrate the on pitch, or at least explain it to them so that they can get an idea of...
Talking on pitch... If you've ever been in an African-American worship service or heard an African-American preacher deliver a sermon, that essentially is what that is, talking on pitch. Unloading rails goes something like, get around the rails here, boys, we're going to unload now. Y'all listen to me, somebody going to get their finger cut off here, foot mash one. Now you get around that, and when I deal a rail, you catch my deal, or let me hold it here, yeah. It's that kind of pitch there. When they are tamping ties or spiking them along the way, you hear a song like, paddle and starting all the live long day. Now, the beat is kept by the men with those spikes. You've got 70 men hitting things at the same time. Paddle and starting, boom, all the live long day, boom. That's the way it's done. And you get stories told to harps. These men are working, so you're not going to get a whole bunch of guitars and things carried out there, because that's too fragile and too bulky. So you get harps. It's the kind of music there. And songs like spirituals told stories. If you want to hear the story of life in the part of Mississippi where he came from, just hear him sing the songs. I have since gone back to Brookhaven, Mississippi, where my father was born and raised. I could find the church, the house, the tract of land, everything, just by using the words from the song. And it was a tract of land 1/4 mile wide, 3/4 mile long. I found the chimney that was in the house where my dad was born. It's now crushed down. These were made of bricks that were made by slave labor, and what the slaves did was carve into the bricks the name of the slave master. And on my mantle now, where I live in Jacksonville, there are several pieces of this brick from that place there. But from his stories and his song, I can go back to where that house is and then tell you where the church is, where the little one house, one room school was, where the kids played, where the little ball fields as such as they had was, because they're all in the songs and the stories. They had already used them. We didn't know until the death of John Kennedy that particular day. We didn't know the recordings existed. We thought this was private stuff that John Lomax did. And I think John Lomax did not tell us anything like that for fear we may not cooperate. My mother, for example, he didn't like it all. And he writes in the Ballad Hunter, Henry's wife was a very stern woman who would not allow Henry to sing worldly music. Let's see, in the 30s, about the time that I was born, my father becomes a preacher. By my mother's decision and protecting her husband's image from these, quote, worldly music, we now don't know the words to some of these, what evidently must have been either rather sensuous social music, that every once in a while you pick up the word baby, sweet honey, and so forth in some of these. My mother called my father Hun, short for honey. My father called my mother sweet. Well, music with those words in it were not considered good church music. Good Christian people just didn't sing that. And when John Lomax asked my dad to sing that old music, my mother objected strenuously. If he had told her this is being recorded for posterity, for historical reason, I think the response may have been different. But he doesn't. And he gets rebuffed. And he writes it. Very stern woman Henry has married. We can date the time that this is done by a tragedy in the family. My mother's youngest brother's wife died in childbirth. They were at the funeral on a day that Lomax just happens to show up with his machine. And he wants Henry to come tell him stories. My dad says to him, we all just come home from the funeral, and in the cemetery, the baby that was born, my mother walks over to her brother and says, give me the child. I will raise the baby with my children. He can call my husband daddy and my children sister and brother. When you get back on your feet, well, you can come back and get your son. Now, Junior Boy was rather fair-skinned. We didn't know why he looked so different. But we thought he was a member of the family. Last one day, at about 8 or 9 years old, his dad came and got him. I had to have this whole thing explained as to how Junior Boy and I are 3 years apart. He lives as a retired professional now in Las Vegas, Nevada. But all of that, the dating of all of that is recorded in John Lomax's Ballad Hunter. But John is totally insensitive to the fact this family is coming home from a grieving situation. He's angry because Henry won't tell him any stories. And he writes it in there. Somebody died. He's got it down there. So there you got it.
I just want to say we folklorists make an attempt not to do that anymore. When we do we do collect, we actually make a much stronger attempt to show sensitivity to the people. But the collections of John Lomax are very important for folklore scholarship and also for preserving things. I wanted to mentioned that, a lot of people, perhaps even you, might have had grandparents or something that sang or performed, and it would have been really nice to be able to have some of that preserved. And that's what we are trying to do here, especially in the folk narrative area. And we're very privileged to have him here. And it's really exciting to hear these stories because John Lomax are legends to me. And so it's very exciting to hear, about something that happened, generations ago. And it's exciting for me to hear that.
There are a lot of misapprehensions. You mean John Lomax did not live among us as a privileged white person who would go off into stay in a motel and then come back. Those things didn't exist. He writes right in the Battle Hunter, I spent last night in the home of Henry Trevelyan. Well, that was totally against the law in Texas at that point. Many times he talks about in Louisiana sleeping under the tree because he didn't have any friends in that area, so he slept alongside of the road. The most outlandish story he tells in there is of a second wife. He marries a woman who gives up a professorship at the University of Texas in Austin to go off with a folklorist the sleep along the roadside in Louisiana with John Lomax. So I thought, woman, you're talking about real love. This had to be it. She gives up the comfort of a university setting and go off with a folklorist. All right. Okay.
You know, that's I could go on for this forever, and we'll.
Any questions? Anything you're open.
I also wanted to mention that this, what you were talking about, is very similar to what happened here with Zora Neale Hurston when she was working for the WPA here. She was told to go out and find, African American folklore and the verbal arts and everything like that, but she wasn't allowed to record them. Stetson Kennedy and other